So since everybody asked, this is in Arizona near Saguaro National Park in Tucson. I did not take the picture, unfortunately. But it's not New Mexico. This cactus is not native to New Mexico. But it looks like a psi. And I wasn't the one who first made this observation. Shohini Ghosh, who's a professor at Wilfrid Laurier, made that observation that you can put a cat around it. I'm going to talk about some work that I've done with Nick Menicucci, who is just finishing up grad school. He's technically at Princeton, although he has spent all his time at the University of Queensland with Jared Milburn, and an experimentalist, Olivier Pfister, and another experimentalist, Simone Severini, an experimental mathematician. And I'm going to talk about this beautiful thing that you can see in the background. And so we've heard a lot about cluster states, but we've always heard about qubit cluster states or discrete variable cluster states. And just to review what these are, we have a bunch of qubits represented by the nodes of a graph, and we initialize them in an eigenstate of the sigma x operator. So that's the plus state here. And then we entangle them with a nearest neighbor interaction. We can imagine doing that with a Hamiltonian, a ZZ Hamiltonian. So we turn that on for some amount of time, and we entangle these qubits. And if we do this on a large lattice, or a lattice with large enough branch width, or something like that, then we get a universal resource state for quantum computation. One appealing feature of this, there's a lot of appealing features of this, but one of them is that the Clifford measurements can be done in any order. And that also carries over in the continuous variable setting. So what is a continuous variable cluster state? Well, in analogy with this other one, it's very natural. Instead of sigma x eigenstates, I'm going to prepare, instead of a qubit here, I'm going to have a Q mode. Daniel, where's Daniel disappeared? Daniel coined that term. Where? Oh, no, there you are. Yeah, you came, you said Q mode.
Maybe he's trying to deny it. He's trying to deny it. But yeah, so these are just oscillators here.
We could call them modes, or if we want to emphasize the fact that we're encoding information in them, we could call them Q modes. I'll just use those interchangeably, or maybe I'll just call them modes because that's what they are. So we're going to prepare them in momentum eigenstates. That's not physical, because those are zero energy states, infinite energy states, but I'll return to that in a minute. And then what we're going to do is we're going to do a two-mode squeezing operation, so a QQ interaction between them. And we're going to do this again on a large lattice, and all the Gaussian operations turn out to be parallelizable. And here are some references. This paper is where it was shown that this is universal if you allow single mode measurements of something non-Gaussian. So for example, photon counting would be an example of that. And there are some advantages to this scheme. Unlike in discrete variable optical cluster states, one can do unconditional state preparation. So you can deterministically prepare the state. We don't have to build the clusters, which is an advantage. And there's a lot of well-established experimental infrastructure that goes along with continuous variables. One other advantage is the fact that, so because I'm using an optical system, addressability is a little bit easier than in other systems where one can do unconditional state preparation, such as in an optical lattice, where addressability, I mean, there are lots of great ideas for addressability, but it's definitely harder than in an optical system. And there's a lot of papers about the discrete variable case. I just selected a few from people that I know are in the audience, but there are definitely others. If I missed yours, I apologize. As somebody said earlier, you're in the dot, dot, dots. I'm sorry about that. Okay, and before I go any further, I'm going to explain to you why this idea will not work. Okay? So, this idea can't work, and the reason is it's not fault tolerant. That's the fundamental reason. Okay, but I'm going to give you three bullet points so I can fill up a whole slide. So first of all, preparing momentum eigenstates is not physical. These are infinite energy states. They can't actually be produced. We can do pretty hard squeezing, but we'll never get an infinite amount of squeezing. And as the computation propagates, you'll tend to your cluster state will degrade because of finite squeezing errors. It's not really known how to do error correction. There are some ideas, but there are not. There are some good ideas, but I think there needs to be more work done on it, and certainly there needs to be some work on fault tolerance. And it's really unlikely that a fault tolerant threshold exists for continuous variables because it's essentially an analog encoding of information, and there's no threshold for analog classical computation. So why would you expect that there would be fault-tolerant analog quantum computation? So we don't actually expect there to be a fault-tolerant threshold. I'll talk a little bit. Well, I'll just mention there are some ideas for how to take continuous variable systems and encode in them a finite dimensional system and use that for a discrete variable encoding. And that could be potentially that could be done. We don't know yet. But so those are all the reasons why this won't work. Now I'm going to tell you why we're excited anyway. Okay, we're excited anyway because what I'm going to talk about is basically implementable with current technology, and it scales up really well. We have a single optical cavity. For those of you who don't know what that is, it's just two mirrors facing each other with some light bouncing around inside. That's all it is, right? I hope there's not an experimentalist in the audience who works with these things, right? Yeah, that's right. The system that we're using will naturally produce in constant depth these very large cluster states, and they will be addressable. And it might be possible to then post-process these to get discrete variable optical cluster states in sort of a one-shot encoding. And of course, there's so many Homer Simpson jokes. So one other exciting reason to study this is you get to have really pretty pictures. You can make donut puns, because this is the state that we're going to create. You can make Homer Simpson jokes based on the donuts. These are all advantages, important advantages. A few more words about the optical, the setup that we're considering. So if you just have two mirrors facing each other, and you have some light bouncing around inside of it, there's a constructive interference, which could happen at certain resonant frequencies. These are the resonant modes of the optical cavity. And they form a bunch of equally spaced lines in frequency space. These two gentlemen, Hensch and Hall, won the Nobel Prize a few years ago for work related to this, related to time and frequency metrology. In between these two mirrors, there's just some very simple medium. And so what we're going to do is we're going to replace that simple medium by a little bit more sophisticated medium. And we're going to let that crystal inside the cavity do the work for us. Okay? So that's the basic idea. So what does the Hamiltonian look like for this system? Graph theorists remain patient. I'll say some interesting graph theoretic things, hopefully interesting graph theoretic things in a little bit. But for now, it's Hamiltonians. A dagger is the creation operator for the nth mode here. G is some symmetric matrix, which describes the couplings between the modes. And K is some squeezing parameter, which tells me how hard I'm squeezing per unit time. And this is in the interaction picture. I'm assuming that the driving field on the optical cavity is a classical undepleted field. And so an example of what one can do with such a system is down conversion in this nonlinear medium. So what I can do is I can, whenever an energy conservation condition is satisfied, so here this is, or equivalently a phase matching condition is satisfied, so I have a pump with an input frequency omega sub pump, or omega sub p. And whenever two other photons at resonant frequency, at the mth or nth resonant frequency of the cavity, whenever I have two of those such that m plus n equals p, I can do a down conversion or maybe an up conversion. So this pump can generate two other photons. And so the symmetric matrix G looks like this. One, if m plus n is p, and zero otherwise. And what this does, this just generates a bunch of entangled pairs, one pair across each value of m and n such that the sum is equal to p. Okay, so those are a bunch of disconnected two-mode continuous variable cluster states. So these are the GHZ states that Robert first talked about. These are, you know, entangled states in continuous variables. And the matrix G, which does this coupling, is just this striped matrix here, just a stripe of ones. Actually, I think I, yeah, there we go. Everything that's not shown is a zero. So this matrix G is clearly a symmetric matrix, but it's got more structure than that. And the structure that it has, these are called Hankel matrices. And they're probably, they're the column flipped version of their more familiar counterpart, the Toeplitz matrices. Okay, so it's pretty much the only thing you can get with a single pump is a bunch of disconnected entangled pairs. So we need to do something a little more than that if we're going to have something interesting to say. So what we're going to do is we're going to add more than one pump. So now the Hamiltonian is a sum over pumps. And for each pump, I have some matrix G, which couples with this condition here. And I'm going to get the same sort of structure. So here, I have G, I guess it will be, so if this pump has frequency 5, is pumping on the fifth resonant mode, which this one is, I will have strength A coupling between these photons. So that's, so what I've got here is on this axis, I have the frequency of the resonant modes inside the cavity. And here is the frequency of the pump shown at the half frequency of its true frequency, because anytime I do down conversion, I cut the frequencies down. That's what down conversion is. So I will generate, so this pump will generate entangled pairs across modes 2 and 3 and across modes 1 and 4 with strength A. This pump will generate entangled pairs across modes 3 and 4 with strength B. And this vector here is just to illustrate that there's, I mean, Hankel matrices are completely specified by their boundary, if you will. And so the graph of couplings for this just looks like this. So 1, 2, 3, and 4, those are just the resonant modes of the cavity. And then the blue and green lines show me how they're coupled by the pump. And so you can see now that I have more than one pump, I'm building up a more complicated structure now, right? So now this is the part of my talk that got a little bit messed up. I had prepared this on an earlier version of the software, and this movie got a little bit messed up, but I'll try to, it still functions, but it's not as nice. So, sorry. Okay, here we go. So here I'm imagining that I have a bunch of pump modes, one here, one here, one here, and one here. This diagonal on the matrix, on this matrix, specifies the sum of the frequencies. And then I can, down here, go. Sorry. I can draw in the pumps at their half frequencies. And then I can put in the resonant modes of the cavity on this axis. And then what we'll see is it'll go. Sorry about this. I don't know. Okay. So each pump generates these couplings, right? So go. Okay. Okay, so yeah, that's all I really wanted to get to. Okay. What does this look like? This looks like a quantum circuit. Okay, let's just, you know, pretend for a minute. This looks like a quantum circuit where here are my inputs, and then I've got a bunch of controlled phase gates, right? And I'm doing them all at the same time, right? So I'm going to have constant depth. And so it's intuitive that maybe I only need order one of these stripes, right, that's going to correspond to the depth of the circuit, in order to couple these guys in such a way that they are coupled like a square lattice. Okay? That's what's going to happen at the end of the day. Okay. Right, so, okay, so I showed you that matrix G, which described the couplings in the Hamiltonian. Okay? But what's the definition of a CV cluster state? It has nothing to do with that matrix G. That matrix G only describes the couplings in the Hamiltonian. The CV cluster state, CV stands for continuous variable. I'm not sure if I defined it. The definition of a CV cluster state is that the quadratures satisfy this condition, where this arrow denotes the limit of infinite squeezing. Okay, so we want something that will converge to this rapidly as the squeezing increases. Okay, so I need that the momentum quadrature minus the adjacency matrix of this continuous variable cluster state times the Q quadrature vanishes. Okay? Okay, so we need to derive, given some G, what does the A look like that I create? Okay? Okay, so the way we're going to do the proof is we're just going to use the fact that if I'm only using Gaussian operations on the vacuum, then I can always represent these as in this symplectic matrix formalism, which I'm sure at least some of you are familiar with. So the unitary associated with the Hamiltonian, e to the minus I t h, looks like this now, e to the minus r g, and then e to the r g, acting on this vector of quadratures, where r now is kappa times t, the total amount of squeezing. P and q now, I'm concatenating them into one long vector of quadratures. Okay? And the condition becomes whatever p and q are, after having operated on them by u and maybe some other trivial operations, I need that this rectangular matrix acting on this long vector vanishes in the limit of infinite squeezing, and we want it to vanish rapidly, too. Okay, so a few more things. So one of the things that was present in my example, but I didn't mention, actually, I should have mentioned it, is that all of those pumps were carefully chosen such that they didn't create any single mode squeezing, okay? So, I don't know if I want to go back through that movie. if I have a pump driving at this half frequency, it will create entangled pairs like this. However, if the half frequency of the pump sits at some other frequency, right? So as an example, if I'm driving at the fourth resonant mode, then I can create two photons at the second resonant mode, because 2 plus 2 is 4, right? And so that's bad. I don't want to do that. So I'm only going to consider pumps that are pumping at an odd resonant frequency, because then these photons are always not frequency degenerate. Okay, I'm trying to avoid that. Okay, so this would be bad. Okay? So when that's the case, the matrix G looks like, it basically means that I must have zeros on the main diagonal. Okay? That restricts the pumps that I can have. So these are the only valid non-zero stripes in G. So G has to look like this. And of course, G is a Hankel matrix, so, and et cetera. So I can only have stripes on these lines, every other line. Whenever that's the case, the adjacency matrix, when G is thought of as an adjacency matrix, I can always factor it. I can tensor factor it like this. So this is just sigma x. And this thing is an unrestricted Hankel matrix now, OK? So Hankel, again, is this constraint that comes from the down conversion physical constraint. So now I've factored it into an unconstrained Hankel matrix, and this thing, which does this spacing for me, OK? Now, as one of those trivial operations that I was suggesting that we do earlier, let me just go back. So I said this vector of quadratures, one of the things that I'm going to do is I'm going to reorder this basis. Which basis reordering am I going to do? So this is a passive transformation, of course, right? I don't actually have to change my experiment to do this. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to reorder the basis like this, sigma x tensor a0. Bring down a new board. A0 is a Hankel matrix. Therefore, it's a symmetric matrix, right? And if I have, if I just do this tensor product, I just get a big 0, a 0, a 0 transpose, which is a 0, 0. That's exactly a bipartite matrix, or sorry, a bipartite graph, right? So this condition just says that G is bipartite, so I can split the modes into two types. And that's actually, it's exactly, one of these will be even, one of these will be odd. That's all it really is. OK. So in the reordered basis, this u, when I exponentiate, looks like this. OK. I'm going to do one additional thing once I've applied this u to the vacuum, is I'm going to do some phase shifting on half of the modes. OK. And it's going to be half in this bipartite split. The matrix that does that in the symplectic formalism that we're using looks like this. Don't worry too much about the details. So everything I've done so far is physically motivated. Now I'm going to do something that's not at all physically motivated, but simplifies the problem really nicely. I'm going to assume that G is, G is symmetric, so I'm going to assume GG transpose is the identity, which is the same now as G squared is the identity. When I do that, I get this identity here, obviously, right? We are all familiar with that. Anybody who's done anything with a qubit knows this identity. Just let R be IR. And then this is what U is, right? Sorry, I'm using some trivial math. 2 plus 2 is 4. yeah?
It's a question that wanted to ask for a while. So does that mean, you're using a certain pump frequencies to drive a number of couplings, or to?
That's right.
And but sort of they are between frequencies further and further apart from the pump pulse.
That's right.
Are you assuming that the couplings that you generate are all equal?
Ah, yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so I am, and the reason I'm doing that is because this is what people try to do in these crystals. So these phase matching.
That's reasonable.
Yeah. So we have the cone, right? The frequency cone, and then I have some phase matching bandwidth, and people go to great lengths to make sure that their phase matching bandwidth is some kind of window function that's really sharp here between the free spectral range between the modes. And then this is some constant, and that determines the strength. And people engineer these things to have that property.
Okay.
So yeah, that's a good point. So I'm going to assume that in this matrix G, that the matrix elements are all essentially constant. So I'm going to assume that they're all, the non-zero ones are plus or minus some constant, or else they're zero. OK, so these things all have constant strength interactions. And of course, one of the goals of the people who think about these photonic quasicrystals, one of the things that they try to do is make that bandwidth really, really large.
right? And I mean, you can shrink the free spectral range to fit more things in, but then addressability gets harder. So there's a trade-off there. Okay, and yeah, some more trivial math. Here's another nice identity for you. But
when we have this matrix U followed by this phase shift matrix T, and we're in this funny reversed tensor product basis, which is sort of not natural, but it's a completely valid thing to do, I can just check that cluster state condition, and I multiply this out, and I get this exponential convergence factor in front. Okay, so this thing converges to a continuous variable cluster state rapidly, which is exactly what we wanted. Okay, and the remarkable thing about this is the A that I've chosen, this A should have been the same, that A, which was the adjacency matrix of the continuous variable cluster state, I meant to write it out, is exactly G. That's why I chose to factor G into something called A naught and sigma X. I foolishly didn't write that out correctly. Sorry. The crucial thing that we've achieved is this simplicity. So now the coupling between the modes exactly defines the adjacency matrix of our continuous variable cluster state. So that's beautiful. Okay. So let's just recap what we've done. We're looking for an adjacency matrix now. I'm just going to forget about G. Okay, G was this physical thing. Now all we care about is A. They're the same thing at this point anyway. So I'm looking for this matrix A, which is the adjacency matrix of our continuous variable cluster state. I want all of its elements to be, all of its non-zero elements to have constant strength. Okay, and this is this bandwidth. This is a physical requirement. I want it to be an orthogonal matrix because that simplifies things. It had better be Hankel, okay, in some up to permutation of the nodes. There had better be some labeling of the nodes where this thing is Hankel, because those are the things that are easy to implement experimentally. And then I want it to be the graph of some universal graph for quantum computation. So I don't want it to be some funny thing. It's got to be, you know, maybe a square lattice or something like that. And it has to be bipartite, so there can't be any single mode squeezing. Okay? And this is one such graph. Okay, so this is, so yeah, donut pun, I don't know, similar bar. yeah, Homer Simpson, yeah, I needed a picture of him holding this or something. Right. Okay, so now let me explain what's involved in determining this. What this thing is. So, the most natural thing to try is to try to put in the adjacency matrix for a square lattice, right? It's easy to see that that can't work, and the reason that that can't work The reason that that can't work is that it has inconsistent boundaries. If the boundaries are irregular, you can never have these conditions satisfied. So you can put some toroidal boundary conditions on it. And if you do that in the most natural way, you find that this condition gets violated. So you have to twist this torus a little bit. And even after you do all that, you realize, oh gosh, you run into equations that look like this. So B and C are some pump strengths that are assumed non-zero. So this is the coupling between, this is some pump strength B, some pump strength C, which I've assumed are non-zero. And I get some equation which looks like that. Well, that implies one of them is zero. So this set of equations can't be solved. But all is not lost. What we're going to do, and I'm going to elaborate this entirely in pictures in a minute, is we're going to use matrix-valued weights to satisfy these equations. Okay, so algebraically, you can just look at these equations and see that if A, B, C, and D are projectors, So four orthogonal projectors on a four-dimensional space, then I can satisfy these conditions, right? Because nothing appears multiplied by itself here. So if they're orthogonal, A times B is 0, A times D is 0, C times D is 0. Each of these equations vanishes term-wise. And the sum of the squares of four orthogonal projectors gives me the identity. Okay? So formally, I can see that I have a solution here if I allow matrix-valued weights in my couplings. Okay? And here's what the adjacency matrix looks like. It's really quite beautiful. For one particular choice, that, and you have to ensure that the graph remains connected when you do this. You can't just use projectors in the standard basis. Otherwise, the graph becomes disconnected. So this is a nice formal solution, but does it have any physical meaning? And the answer is yes. We're going to use, so what we can basically do is we can use the fact that our frequency comb has polarization degrees of freedom. Okay. So if this is the mth mode, I can use vertical and horizontal polarizations of photons in that same mode. And then I can intercouple, I can use the crystal to actually intercouple between those modes. Okay? So here I have 4x4. So what's happening is the blocks in this matrix now are labeling frequency degenerate modes, and I've packed four modes in per frequency, okay, which is, you know, twice as many as I could do with polarization, but I'll show you how to fix that in a second. But that's what we're going to do. There's one other trick that we can do. Oh, this is a pretty small example, too, because, well, anyway. So if we look at these blocks, we can see, again, that it has that same stripe structure, where every second stripe is unoccupied, okay? Which means I can just reorder this basis again. And if you do that, then I can shrink these blocks to 2x2 blocks, okay? That it's not important to see the details there, but yeah, you can do that. So what's going on here? So what we've done is we've got this big lattice. Each node here now is essentially four frequency degenerate nodes. Each one of these colors is a projector now, okay? And the condition A squared equals the identity, I can write that out as the jkth element of A squared is equal to a sum on AJL, ALK. Okay, it's symmetric, so it doesn't really matter what I put there. And this has to equal delta JK. Okay? These things are now vanishing. All these products now are between projectors. Each one of these is an orthogonal projector. So red times yellow, 0. Red times blue, 0. Yellow times blue, 0. So all length two paths now vanish. Okay? That's what this equation says. This is, you know, the total weight of a path of length two, where the weight is the product of the individual edge weights. But every node, this is a vertex transitive graph now. Okay? I mean, I've completely forgotten about the boundaries. That's why it looks ragged there. But forgetting about the boundaries for now, and just believe me, this is a vertex transitive graph. So every vertex has one of each color incident on it. And when I sum the squares of these colors, right, I get the identity. Here's a smaller example which sort of zooms in a little bit and shows you what's going on here. I have two physical modes here, and then I have couplings between them. This is a complete bipartite graph between these supernodes over here. So yeah, between each supernode, I have all possible couplings for just one edge across. So the blue here represents +1. The yellow represents -1 up to some overall normalization. And if I add up all length two pads on this graph, I'll always get zero unless I'm calculating the length two paths back to myself. So yeah, if I have a length two path from this guy to somebody two away, which is not himself, I will always get a zero total weight. But if I calculate it back to myself, I'll always get one. And this is just a zoom in showing, you know, these matrix valued weights, what the idea is here. Oops, duplicated the slide. So just a little bit more about the boundary conditions. They're pretty trivial. It's a pretty trivial difference. It's just one extra twist in one dimension. So I don't have to do a whole lot of twisting to roll this torus up in a natural way. So I still get a really big square lattice when I unravel this thing. And just to show you what this looks like when I zoom in, I get this four-partite structure. And these are these matrix valued weights. So how do I actually compute with this thing, right? Well, maybe there's a better way, but the most naive way is I measure away 3/4 of the qubits and just get rid of them, and then I'm left with this large torus that I've created in, you know, constant depth. Okay? And so yeah, those were the pretty pictures. Okay, so the global topology is this twisted torus. There's actually multiple ways to roll it up. I picked this one isn't optimal if you want to do the computation, but it's prettiest, so I used that one here. Okay, so how large can these things be? Okay, it turns out that in these optical frequency combs, the phase matching bandwidth is about 10 to the so. In the best experiments, they can pack about 10 to the 6 modes inside these things. So we're talking about 10 to the 6 different modes here. Although with these nonlinear crystals, that's not achievable. But with rather ordinary laboratory technology, we're talking about 10 to the 4. So 10 to the 4 divided by 4 macro nodes here on this thing, and that should be doable, you know, in the very near future. And all of this uses just 15 pumps. Okay, so I have 5 minutes.
Yep. 12, 13 minutes.
I thought it was over 12.
Yep.
Is that rich questions?
Oh, yeah, that's included.
Oh, okay. Okay, so what are they doing? So what is on the, so right now, we'd had some earlier results. Before we had this nice construction of this torus, we had a bunch of disconnected squares. And so they've already built this experiment, so they're running it right now. There have been some other experiments that have done cluster state quantum computations with squares. And they were a little bit involved. They had, you know, multiple down conversion events. I mean, this is all in the discrete variable setting. There was a very recent paper where they did continuous variable cluster state with a square, but they have a rather large experimental setup. Here we're already set up to do lots of disjoint squares with, you know, basically one pump and a single crystal, and that's it. So the whole thing is very, very compact. So the thing that they're going to set up after that is these large rings, okay? And you need two pumps for that. Here's what the adjacency matrix looks like. You get some really large ring. These rings are universal for single mode transformations, so we can do an arbitrary single mode computation with this. And then finally, in a slide I call irresponsible speculation, because there's been some talk about anyons at this conference. This might be able to provide a test bed for testing some, or for at least, you know, seeing some anionic statistics in a sort of easy way without having to look at fractional quantum Hall systems or other more complicated solid state type things. So it's probably well known to many of the people here that if I measure some certain pattern of measurements on a cluster state, I recover the Kataev-Torres code state. Okay, this can be generalized to the continuous variable setting. It's pretty straightforward. And when you do that, you see anions that have continuous statistics. Okay, so they don't have a discrete spectrum of phases. They you can have any phase when you braid them around each other. One could imagine creating this large torus, measuring these modes, creating this toric code state, and then observing anionic statistics as a phase shift when I braid these things around. That's not inconceivable. And then, as an even crazier footnote, the 4D toric code. So Andrew mentioned this briefly in his talk, right? How do you get a 4D torus? Well, you have to go talk to the string theorists, open up an extra dimension, and build your lattice in there. Or you can use the fact that inside this cavity, I'm basically indexing a four-dimensional array with a single integer, right? And so I can couple these modes in what is essentially naturally a four-dimensional way, but I do it all with a single integer. One can construct a four-dimensional torus using these ideas. The drawback is you have to take advantage of other frequency degenerate couplings. So one needs to take advantage of spatial degrees of freedom or something like that. And that's a lot harder experimentally. But and then, of course, at the end of the day, this is why all this is irresponsible speculation. You've encoded a continuous variable into your four-dimensional torus. So, what good is that? I don't know. but it's interesting. Just a couple minutes left. So, some open questions. So the biggest open question is fault tolerance for continuous variables. As I said earlier, it doesn't seem like that should be possible, but maybe we could do something. Maybe there exist schemes for mitigating finite squeezing errors or something like that. The thing that I'm optimistic about, although who knows how difficult this is experimentally, is to take our large continuous variable cluster state and convert it to a discrete variable encoding using the Gottesman-Kataev-Preskill encoding. And that would be a two-step way to generate large optical cluster states using this GKP encoding. Another open question, it would be really interesting. We have this four-fold degeneracy. It would be really interesting to take advantage of that to use that redundancy to protect against errors. And another question, so we know how much squeezing we can get in the lab. What can we do with just that amount of squeezing and not too many fancy tricks to correct for that? Can we do some sort of non-trivial quantum computation? Can I get up to maybe a 10 by 10 cluster state or a 20 by 20 cluster state? You can imagine doing pretty interesting things. Nothing that a classical computer can't do currently, of course, but pretty interesting for experimentalists with a cluster state of that size. Okay, so I just wanted to, I didn't actually mention Simone's contributions. Simone has, we're trying to classify all the matrices that satisfy those conditions. So we're looking for these so-called weighing matrices. So these are generalized Hadamard matrices, right? As Chris Gotzel said in his talk. So we want them to be orthogonal and Hankel and satisfy these conditions. So we're trying to understand the structure of those things, and Simone is working hard on that. But here are the theorists that are working on it, myself and Nick Manicucci. Hussein Zaidi doesn't do physics anymore, as far as I know, but he was involved early on, so I should definitely give him credit for what he's done. There are experimentalists who are doing all the hard work of actually building these things and building these crystals that do phase matching. And we have some papers here This is going to be the long version that goes into a little more detail. And there's an archive preprint, which we just put up a couple days ago, that talks about the details. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve. Any more questions? How do you measure it for computation?
Oh, so yeah. Well, you need to. So the light comes out of it. So I have a cavity, and the light comes out. I need to have some kind of prism or something, right? So I need to separate these frequency modes into spatial modes, and then I mean you're going to have to scale up the number of detectors, and so there are ideas involving integrated optics and things like this, but we haven't thought hard about it. But you're essentially going to need to have single mode detectors for every spatial mode there. I mean, you can't get around needing n different measurements, right? For any scheme, you're going to need to do a large number of measurements. But I think the idea is to just spread them out and then start measuring. I'm not sure. Yeah.
How many modes can you get in a single cavity? I mean, at some point, the frequency is going to get to your highest.
But we're imagining that the free spectral range is lower bounded by some constant, and that we're changing the properties of the crystals and the length of the cavity in order to increase the number of modes. So we're going to increase the phase matching bandwidth in order to achieve that. So it's 10 to the 4 is the estimate that we came up with using current technology, current crystals, like a 1.5 meter cavity. And you can play tricks like slow light. I'm sure there are lots of tricks, but I don't know.
And how good does the cavity have to be to have like exact frequency modes in the form?
I'm not sure. I think that, so what do you mean by exact here, right?
That you can still resolve the frequency states later in the measurement and you would read out.
I don't think any better than what they use for the classical frequency cones, the classically coherent optical frequency cone, because those things are those fringes. I mean, those peaks are really well resolved. So I don't think that's.
When doing the measurement, if one thing of doing it sequentially, like you read out, and you have to kind of make fiber loops, and then you measure, and then you have another coming
that's,
up, you measure with the same device, but.
Time multiplexing. I think they're thinking of using filter cavities instead. One could do all kinds of tricks. I mean, you're going to have to do these tricks if you want anything to scale. So yeah, I think time multiplexing on a fiber using the same detector, that's one idea.
Okay, well, let's thank Steve again.